brain is just electrochemical energy is what it is, right? But that electrochemical energy is influenced by other people's electrochemical energy. So if we can notice the states that we're in and notice the states that somebody else is in, we can choose to join the party or we can choose not to.
Hey, it's Kristen, and welcome to a conversation that truly has the potential to completely revolutionize your understanding of the people you love in your life, especially when they are mad or sad or frustrated. My guest today is Alicia Braccia, who I've had the great fortune to know for about 5 years through our daughter's Montessori school. Alicia is a Florida licensed school psychologist with a master's degree in school psychology based in Lake Mary, Florida, where she created the Center for Health, Learning, and Achievement. What I love about Alicia, what I've always loved about Alicia, is that she has such a clear understanding of how the brain impacts our behavior. And when you have kids, especially little ones, this can be really helpful because their behavior can be really, really frustrating. But what you'll hear in this conversation ahead is that there's a reason why our kids act the way they do during certain moments, and the answer lies in neuropsychology. In fact, understanding some key elements of brain function can help us all understand everyone's behavior, including our own. It doesn't matter if you're a parent or a CEO, a surgeon or a hockey coach, the principles of brain function and neuropsychology are universal. And when we can understand what's happening inside the brain when people we love get upset or frustrated, as well as feel joyful and safe, we can create better connections and relationships with those around us. By the end of this episode, you will seriously have a new skill that can exponentially make your family and work life better. So welcome to The Synced Life. Let's get started. So Alicia, I think that the reason why I'm really excited about this conversation is that there's a design to the brain that when we understand it, when we are even aware of it, can really help us in our relationships with each other, whether it's with our kids or with our spouse or with someone having road rage. It's really helpful that we can understand that the structure of the brain causes us to behave in certain ways at certain times. So I wonder if you could just start by kind of giving us a little bit of a biology lesson on the parts of the brain, those three main parts of the brain, and how they kind of interact with each other.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely major sections of the brain, and this is an oversimplified version, but it is helpful to think about kind of three main areas of the brain that interact and affect the way that we communicate and have relationships with children and adults and partners. Becky Bailey took Loria's model of three main sections. There's the brain stem, which is kind of where the spinal cord comes into the center of the brain. And that is the earliest part of our evolution. And it really is responsible for just our basic needs, respiration, sleep, heart rate. And then from there, it moves up into the limbic area, which is the center of our brain. That limbic area is our emotional center. It's where pleasure happens, where fight or flight happens, where all of our, you know, angry and sad and anxious happens. And then on top of that sits our thinking brain. And that's the highest centers of our brain that process all of the information that's coming through the limbic system and saying, what do we do with this? And the most important part of that, that cortex, that outer layer of the brain is our frontal lobe. Now, humans have the largest frontal lobe, and it is the area of the brain that makes us human because it's kind of the boss. It's the executive, and it says, okay, is this information that's coming in through our emotional centers, is this something that we've experienced before? Should we be afraid of it? Should we react quickly? How do we organize it? How do we plan? If it's not important or it's not a big deal, then we really don't have to, you know, activate our fight or flight mode or our emotional centers. But if it is a big deal, then now we have to problem solve. What do we do about this? So what happens when we get into kind of altercations or conflicts is we can either stay in our survival mode, fight or flight mode, where we might feel really tense in our chest, where we might be breathing very heavy, we might feel our heart rate going, that is not a place to problem solve. Right? Or if we see our partner or our children in this fight or flight mode, it's not a time to have a discussion. We might be seeing them very physical, hitting or fighting or on the floor having a tantrum, right? And our goal at that moment is to notice the state that they're in, to try and shift them out of that into more of a problem-solving state. And that takes time. And the ability to just kind of maintain or regain composure through de-escalating the environment, through breathing, through a quiet spot. And then and only then can they move into their thinking brain.
Yeah, and I think we can get really detailed about some of the tactics for de-escalating not only other people's brains, but our own brains as well. But is it helpful, or have you heard these parts of the brains labeled, the reptile brain, the mammal brain, and the human brain? Is that kind of a way to sum? Okay, super. I want to make sure we're using the same vernacular.
Yeah, that's Luria's model. He was a neuropsychologist.
Yeah.
And the reptilian brain is that survival state. It's that base of the brain that's responsible for basic needs. And the mammalian brain is that inner brain, that more limbic emotional state. And then you've got your frontal lobe, your cortex.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting when you think about the actual hardware of the brain, like actually how the brain was designed, that reptile brain is the most protected. It's the least likely to be injured because of where it's located. Whereas that human part of the brain at the front, you imagine, if you were in a car accident, that's the most likely part of the brain to be injured in a head-on collision, let's say. So when we think about the parts of the brain and almost like a hierarchy of importance, our reptile brain, we don't want to throw it under the bus in this conversation. It's actually really important, and we probably wouldn't survive without it. Would you say that's true?
Well, yeah, because it's our heart rate and respiration, so we definitely wouldn't survive without it.
Yeah, but we could survive without our human brain. Maybe we wouldn't have very good relationships, or we wouldn't be able to tie our shoes anymore, things like that. But we could function, at least as a human being. We could get through our day without our human section of our brain.
Our cortex is the last to evolve. And so it is the most susceptible to insult, but it's also trainable. Unless there's a massive lesion or, brain trauma to your frontal lobe, there will be personality changes, there'll be behavioral changes, because it does regulate our ability to interact with others.
Yeah. So give me an example. If someone's in front of me and they're up and they are in a, I would love to go through each section of the brain and how I would be able to tell which section they're in. You know what I'm saying? Is by looking at either my child or my spouse or even myself, how do I know what are sort of the signs or the symptoms of reptile brain, mammal brain, and human brain?
Yeah. And I kind of call it survival state, emotional state, and executive state.
Awesome.
So your survival state, if you, and I always say we have to recognize it in us first. So if we are feeling our chest tightening, our breath, our breathing getting faster, our heart rate elevating, if we're starting to sweat, that we are in a survival state and we are either going to fight or flee or surrender or we're going to lie. So same thing, if we notice that in ourselves first, then we're able to notice it in others. So if we start to see our spouse or our child start to breathe heavy, start to clench their fists, start to, sweat, their face gets red, they're in a survival state. And the whole motive during that state is, am I safe? And so if we can notice and know that they need the answer, they need the question, am I safe, answered, then we're able to start to shift them. So they're seeking safety at that time. And the skill to use during that survival state is composure, is helping them become more composed. And that may be just walking away and letting them be composed. Or it may be helping them to start to breathe more regularly, to close their eyes, to use more, calming imagery. Now, if they're in an emotional state, then you might see more more language coming out, more verbal outbursts. That's the point where we start to think about tapes, old tapes in our heads of, why are they not treating me this way? Or why are they treating me this way? I shouldn't be talked to like that. They don't appreciate me. That's emotional state. So the whole question at that state is, am I loved? And if we can answer that question through them, for them, am I loved, by holding or hugging or breathing with them, or saying, you're safe, then they will be able to shift. So the emotional state looks like yelling or ignoring or tattling is an emotional state, blaming is an emotional state, being sassy and back talk is an emotional state. And again, our goal is to answer the question, am I loved?
Yeah, what's really interesting about this work is that I can see that if I'm with someone who is deep in their survival state or they're deep in their emotional state, unless I'm really aware of what's happening in my nervous system, that behavior might actually trigger my reptile brain to turn on or my, emotional state to kick in. And now we've got two reptiles trying to talk to each other or two mammals trying to talk to each other. Neither of us are in our executive function of our brain. I remember many years ago, we were working with a coach named Carrie Conti, who's actually been on this podcast a few times. And we were talking about how when Elizabeth would get upset, and this is, when she was much younger, that actually there was kind of I had some trauma over here around it. Like it would bother me. And she taught me to say to Elizabeth when she was upset, I'm okay that you're upset. And it did two things. It told her that I was steady, that I was keeping my composure, as you had just said, but it actually told my nervous system that I was okay, that I was going to keep my composure. And then like fast forward, I don't know, 8 years later, Mark and I were having a conversation. We've been married almost 15 years, just a couple of months ago. And he was saying how he realizes that when I'm upset, it really triggers him. Like he wants to fix it. He just wants to make me okay because he hates when I'm upset. It's really affects his nervous system. And I said, hey, you should try that thing that Carrie taught us. You should look at me and say, I'm okay that you're upset. And so he does. And it really works. It works for both of us because I get the little trigger that like, oh, I'm upset. I didn't even notice that I was upset. And he gets to tell his nervous system like, this is okay. She's just upset.
Yeah. So we can, you know, when the brain is just electrochemical energy is what it is, right? But that electrochemical energy is influenced by other people's electrochemical energy. So if we can notice the states that we're in and notice the states that somebody else is in, we can choose to join the party or we can choose not to. And disengage. Now, by saying to somebody else, I see that you're upset, and it's okay that you're upset. It's in a way saying, I don't have to join that party.
Yeah.
But it's also at the same time saying you're loved and I recognize that you're upset, because that's empathy. And sometimes that's all we need is for somebody to know, I'm upset. I don't need you to fix it. I just need you to know that I'm upset.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love how when you said about disengaging, that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, putting your partner or your kid in time out and saying, you know, see ya, I can't handle this. It's actually quite the opposite. It's saying I can handle this. I can handle that you've gone a little sideways here.
And it's also mirroring to the other person a better way to do it. See, if we get into the mix and we're both in emotional states, then that the other individual, you know, then it's just a blame game. Well, you made me feel that way and you are doing this and it's your fault that I'm here. But if you can say, hey, I see you are really upset right now. So there are some things that we can do together, or there's things that you can do on your own. You can go into the other room and just lay down and regain your composure and breathe and get calm. Or if you need my help, you're loved and we can go in together and just hold each other.
Mm, I love that. What if you're not okay and that the other person's upset? I'm thinking about a time a couple of months ago when Mark was talking about some finance stuff that he was stressed about, some work stuff, and something was going to end up costing a lot more money than he thought. And he was activated by it. He was triggered. Mm-hmm. And I started getting triggered by it. And I thought to myself, gosh, I'm not being helpful anymore. Cause now I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, this is a bad situation. I'm upset. Now I'm triggered by this. So how do you handle that if you really do feel yourself, like you said, joining the party? Do you just acknowledge it?
Yes. You can say, you know what? I am feeling really anxious or I'm really feeling upset now. I just need to step back and then I'm going to be much more useful. But if I stay in this, and you don't have this long of a conversation with children, but with partners, yes, you can say, I just need to step back in order to, you know, calm myself down. And then I'm going to be able to think better versus just staying with it. It communicates two things. It communicates, yes, you're hearing them. And yes, you understand that they are upset. But that being there with them is not useful at that moment in time.
So what if we are ourselves? We've fallen into our reptile brain. We've fallen into our mammal brain. So we're in either a highly activated survival state or emotional state. Obviously, our body and our emotions trigger it. We can go, oh gosh, like we can feel that physically that we've moved into one of those states. But how do we start walking ourselves back from that?
Talk to me a little bit more about what you mean.
So say I've maybe just been in a near, like, terrible car accident, or I've gone to the bank and they were, you know, supposed to be handling something for me that feels like stressful and it's just not getting handled properly. Like something is stressing me out and is really conjuring up some real feelings of anger or like fight or flight or just upset. How do you walk yourself back from that? And the reason why I ask that is, I guess I kind of wonder how we help someone else do that. And I feel like the first step is learning how that skill for ourselves, how to get ourselves out of our reptile and animal brains.
Yeah. Dr. Bailey talks about the power of acceptance because some of it is, so the example of you at the bank, right? Yeah. So when we start to get aggravated in our mind, we're saying, well, they should get this. They should be able to fix this. You know, there's that blame game. It should be this, or, you know, it could be this. Instead of accepting, okay, it is what it is right now. This is what's happening at this moment in time, releases us again from that emotional blame game. And we can then have a choice. We can say, all right, this person is supposed to be helping me. They're not. So it is what it is. I'm going to just walk outside and take a breath and maybe try this with somebody else versus staying in that where this person obviously is not helpful at that moment in time. You know, I think we get into the shoulds, and then that causes more angst within us instead of just saying, okay, it is what it is. And that doesn't mean that we're passive and let it, you know, that it's all okay and fine, but it does enable us to handle our emotions better.
Okay, here's a question. Why, when we're upset, and why especially when our kids are upset, so I could be upset about one thing, let's say, or my Allie, for example, she's really legendary for doing this, where she gets upset about whatever the thing was that activated the upset. But then in the midst of this, like the throes, this hurricane of upset, then she starts bringing in things that happened yesterday, and she's it's always like this, and this thing that happened 2 days ago, and now this, and I mean, she's pulling in things that I'm like, why does she do that? Why do we do that? Because I think as adults we do that too. We start to make it starts to like snowball, like literally, like it grows and grows and grows. Do you have any sort of hypothesis on that?
Yeah. So our emotional state is in the center of our brain. It's our limbic system. Well, also what's in our limbic system is our long-term memory. So when we are in that frantic state of emotions, all of our memories of past events and things that have hit us, it's right in that same place. And so they all come out as well. Structurally in the brain, they're in the same place.
Wow. So it's like they opened up a file cabinet and like all the files came out.
All the files came out. And especially files that are emotionally charged. Those are our strongest memories. Whether they're negatively emotionally charged or positively emotionally charged, those are the most ingrained. And that's what I kind of talk about, those old tapes, those past tapes, that CD-ROM that's in our brain. And by recognizing, just acknowledging and noticing when those old CD-ROM tapes come out, those old memories, that's the key to being able to stop and say, I don't have to do it that way anymore. Or when Allie's talking about, well, this happened and that happened and that happened, just to say, wow, you really seem upset right now.
Yeah, that's not what I do. What I do, and I can see in this conversation that that I mistakenly do, is I try to reason with her in that moment. What do you mean you're not? Maybe she's saying I'm so stupid, and I'll say, what do you mean? Look at your science project that you did. Don't you remember how amazing you did in your historical presentation? Like, what about this? What about your spelling test? Like, I start trying to activate her executive function.
Right. And she can't do it at that moment in time. So there is something that we talked about in the session the other day called the DNA formula. So when Allie or Elizabeth's in that state, you know, D is to describe. So describe what you see. So, wow, your face is all scrunched up and your face is red. And then you name it. You seem really frustrated right now. That's the naming it. And then acknowledging it. You wanted this to happen, but you didn't know how to ask. Or you wanted this to happen and that was really disappointing. And you're acknowledging it. That's being empathetic. It's not changing it, but it's acknowledging it. And then you can say, you can handle this.
Oh, I love that. That's the missing key right there. And I think before, when we talked about being able to say out loud to your child or your spouse or even to yourself, like, I'm okay that you're upset.
Yes.
I think when we say that to our kids or ourselves or our spouse or our friend, we're not only saying that to them, like, you hear it, that I believe you can handle it, but we're actually telling our nervous system, this is a human over there that can handle what's happening. And that, like, to me, that makes me feel safe. When I acknowledge that the person in front of me who's upset can handle it, then I feel safe. Isn't that funny how it mirrors back to us like that?
Yes, it absolutely does, because then we don't engage in that energy. So so I can handle this has a meaning that's different than you'll be okay. It's not a big deal. That's not empathetic. But being able to say, I see you doing this. And naming what it is, and then acknowledging, yes, you wanted to stay at the park longer. That's acknowledging it. You can handle this is different than you'll be fine. It's not a big deal, because it is to them at that moment in time.
Yeah, man, I love that so much. That's really, really good stuff. So let's talk a little bit about some of the tactics around sort of walking ourselves and our kids back from these really highly charged emotional situations. You said earlier, you talked about deep breathing, getting, physically close to each other. Obviously, if someone's flailing and punching, you're not going to want to put your arms around them. But let's talk about some of the strategies of helping us move away from some of our uncomfortable moments.
So I think the biggest thing that we need to recognize is sometimes we don't always take the time to reconnect. When someone is in distress or we're in distress, right? It requires four main things to kind of connect with somebody in order to help them shift. So eye contact is really important. Because again, it says to the individual, I'm with you and you're safe and you're loved. And touch also adds to that message. You're safe, you're loved. And it shows that you're really present, that in your mind, you're not also thinking about other things. You know, my daughter used to be, we'd be driving in the car and I'd be thinking about what I have to do at work when I get to work, and she was next to me and she could feel me thinking about something and say, are you okay, Mom? Now, nothing was being said verbally, but you can feel it. So to be present with the individual, whether it's your spouse or your kid, and to be able to show them through touch and eye contact is so critical in order to shift them into a more executive, calmer state. And then I think being playful is so important too. You know, sometimes just being able to make a joke or laugh shifts them out of that survival or emotional state.
Why, when our children or even ourselves, let's be honest, when we actually go through a bit of an emotional blow up, I know why we feel shame afterwards, because we go really deep in our survival and our emotional brain, and we act in ways that we don't normally behave. Maybe they're even against our values. And so when we kind of wake up from it and we're back in our executive part of our brain, we're like, oh man, why did I do that? So talk to me about how to be with our kids when the shame storm comes in after they're finally feeling better, and now they're just really embarrassed about how they maybe treated their sibling or treated you, or just that they lost it.
Yeah. So I always like the idea, and we model this. We model the ability to have an oops, and we can pivot away from that and say, you know what, we did something that kind of goes against what we wanted to happen, and knowing that why it happened, but we also can choose to do it differently the next time. Now, we can't do it in that moment, but if your spouse or yourself or your child comes to you and says, you know, I'm so sorry that I did that. Well, just permission to say, everybody makes mistakes. It is okay. What can we do next time so that we don't get into that situation again? But you can't do that until after they're back into their composure.
Yeah. And sometimes we have to let it marinate for quite some time. I know this morning Elizabeth and I had a little bit of some conflict because she tends to dawdle in the morning, and I have to, you know, be on her a little bit a few times. Did you brush your teeth yet? Did you brush your hair yet? And you know, she's 10, and we ended up leaving a little bit later than I wanted to. And I said on the way to school that it really felt disrespectful that, you know, she just doesn't manage herself really well in the morning. And she got, you know, she got a little triggered from it, and she looked really frowny in the rearview mirror. And I knew it was just time I wasn't going to harp on it. It was time to change the subject. And I didn't really like starting the day that way, but I was like, you know what? I'm just going to leave it. Like, it's fine. I'm allowed to give her some constructive feedback. I wasn't yelling or anything like that. And then I pick her up from school, and we're walking to the car, and she puts her arm around me, and she says, I know I could do better in the morning. I'm going to do better, I promise. And I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? If I had just stayed on her this morning, I don't know, that probably would have gone really sideways. But being able to let her marinate for a little while was really, really helpful, I think.
Well, again, she needed the time to shift out of that emotion to our frontal lobe. Your frontal lobe is your problem solver. So now she's got that, okay, I know that I can do better, but that's a really good door, that opening to say, that's so awesome that you want to do better. So do you need help figuring out how to make it easier in the morning? Or is this something you want to develop yourself?
Oh, I wish you had have been there.
So then your choice, but you can still do that. So you can say to her, you know what? I loved how you kind of marinated over that during the day. And you said to me at the end of the day that you want to do better. So do you need help figuring out a way to do better? Or is this something that you want to try and create yourself? I'm here for you if you want that help.
I love that. Love it. So I know I'm kind of jumping back and forth, but you said something a couple minutes ago about playfulness and how important that is to relationships. And I think we can actually say all relationships, our spouse and maybe even our extended family and our kids. Talk to me a little bit about why that is and what that kind of looks like. Because I can imagine playing with my kids, but, chasing them around the house to get in the bath and stuff like that. I mean, I get that. But how do we bring like a lightness and a playfulness to the adults in our lives?
So important. So a lot of it just has to do with time. As adults, we get busy. And so we get very internally focused. I've got to do this, and I've got to do this, and I've got this to happen, and this to happen. And we have to just have time to stop and look outside of us and be playful with the other person, whether it's a playful text in the middle of the day, or whether it's, surprising them when you come home, or let's go for a walk. Or I heard this really funny story today. Or here's a video that I saw that was really funny. It's making a connection in a playful way that's kind of unexpected. And I think in relationships, we kind of lose that over time. We get a little lazy. And I think it's really important every single day at some point in time to be able to make a connection. Eye contact, touch, and playfulness and presence with your spouse, with your children, with your friends. And we don't take the time to do that.
I think you're so dead on. When I look at, especially marriages, or any relationship that is like with a spouse or a partner, as the years pass, I think playfulness is the one thing that really suffers the most, because we get, especially when you add kids, we get so functional. It's like you do this, you do that. I remember telling people when we went from one child to two children, well, that was really hard on our marriage, because now it was divide and conquer. I'm nursing, so you take that one to the park, or we're going to have a nap, so you take this one with you to run errands. And we got so focused on like the business of running our family, like just management of the household, that you sort of become like business people together, and the playfulness really goes, but without some intention. I can really see that without some intention and without having playfulness that's at least in your relationship in some way, how it kind of hardens. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So again, if our whole motive as humans is connection with another person or people, right? And our whole question in ourselves is, am I safe? Am I loved? Then for 5 minutes every day, you need to be with somebody and communicate that you're safe and you're loved every day.
I love that. When you meet people and they first start to understand what you do in the world of psychology and neuropsychology, what's sort of your elevator speech as to why people should know about this? Not should, but why it's helpful to, as human beings, and maybe even especially as parents, to get a little training on what's happening inside the skulls of all the people around us.
Well, it's very objective, right? So, I find that women really like to talk about things, and we're more emotional, and so we're more touchy-feely, but not necessarily men. Men like to know more concrete factual information. It's just the way that they're wired. So knowing about the brain and understanding the brain and neurochemistry and structures make something that's very kind of, touchy-feely more objective. And they get it. They're like, okay, now I understand why I have to do this. Not just because it's something that she wants, but there's actually a structural need for that. So I'll show parents, families, the brain and talk to them. I, you know, do a lot of assessment on learning and attention and executive functions. And if you can see it, it's easier to understand what you need to do about it. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm even thinking for myself that, you know, there's been times where I've like spun out a text or cranked out an email in my either reptile or animal brain, either in a very survival mode or a very emotional mode. And in hindsight, I think, oh my God, I wish I'd sat on that for 24 hours or even 24 minutes. So yes. Being able to just hit the brakes and go, whoa, giving it a label, I think is really helpful as well, because now I can say, oh, whoa, I am super in survival mode right now. I am feeling really attacked. I'm feeling really threatened. And what's going to come out is just a way to survive this situation rather than to create harmony or to try to repair the relationship or whatever. Being able to recognize that we have different parts of our brain that we move to and know that it's not a good idea for me to communicate or send texts or send emails or post something on Facebook when I'm in one of those states. I think, like you said, I think in dealing with our kids too, it helps to be able to say, or even our spouse, like, okay, they're not being a jerk or they're not being bratty or whatever other labels we could put on it. Being able to say, oh, they're just being little alligators right now. Like they're just totally, or when you see other kids having meltdowns out in the world, being able to go, oh, well, like kid's really reptilian right now. And rather than judging the parent, like, oh, wow, she's really lost control of her kid. Like, geez, like, I think it's really great to have these containers to be able to understand our brain. So tell me, obviously this doesn't make you immune to conflict. I'm sure you fight with your partner and your daughter and things like that. But I bet this work and being able to dive into this research and this sort of scientific field has really helped you. So tell me a little bit about how it impacts your life and your day-to-day personal living of, you know, Alicia, the human being.
Well, and I also think that age helps too.
Yes.
Because when you're in it, when you're younger and you've got kids and work and everything, again, we move so fast that we don't take time to notice. And so now I'm 55 and my daughter's grown and I've created a practice that really is the way that I want it to be versus the way that everybody else wants it to be. So you're always kind of looking at what does other people think about me when I was younger. And now it's, you know, this is my values and my goal in my life. And so if I stay with that intention and those goals in my life, I'm a happier person. And then my happiness goes towards other people's happiness, right? Because we're linked energetically. I just think it's experience and not getting caught in the small stuff and noticing when that CD-ROM in my brain that says I'm not good enough, you know, that's not real. That's a perception. It's my perception and it doesn't have to be that way. So if my perception is a certain way, it causes an emotion, which then causes a behavior. So the first part is really noticing the perception and the state.
Well, and what I hear you say is that it's a practice. Like, it's a skill. It's something that we learn to do over time. We don't suddenly say tomorrow, like, oh, okay, I have a better understanding of the brain and I am no longer going to lose my temper. And I am always going to interface with my children, regardless of what state they are in, with a state of calm and, you know, total equilibrium. Like, no, that's not going to happen. But this is one of the reasons why I'm such a huge proponent of having a daily practice where we, I don't know, meditate, if that feels right for you, or journal, but we practice, like you said, tuning into our own thoughts, our own way, our state, our own, you know, really just like the patterns that have been going on in our brains, what we've been thinking about, what we've been worrying about. Because when we do that, to me, you start to strengthen the muscle of the noticing. And so when you're in one of those like hyper emotional states, you're more likely to pull yourself back from it faster. And maybe it's 5 minutes after, maybe it's 2 minutes after, and maybe it's right before you lose it. You know?
Right. There's a 7 second delay. So when we have a thought, you have 7 seconds before it actually takes action. Right. And that's a neurological thing. So if we are able to notice more and pay attention to where we're at, we have more time to actually pivot before it comes out. And what we pay attention to every day, we get more of. So we can choose to pay attention to more positive things, have positive intent, and then we'll get more of that. Or we can choose to have more of a negative intent or more negative thoughts, and we're going to get more of that. What we pay attention to, we get more of.
Yeah, I've heard it say, what you appreciate appreciates.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts or any final advice you'd love to leave for us and me and the listeners?
I just think that, you know, we're so often looking at others on what they are doing and how that they are aggravating us. And what has to happen first is recognizing what's happening within ourselves. No one can make us feel anyway. No one controls the way that we feel. We are in control of ourselves. And the more that we can focus on how we're feeling, the more that we can shift the behaviors and emotions of others.
And can you teach that to kids? I mean, I know that I've said those words to my kids, but to them, it really feels like their sister made them feel mad or whatever, like that there was something that happened out there that produced an emotion in here, and now they're blaming and all of that. I feel like it's hard to get them to see that. Probably hard to get adults to see that.
Yeah, so I do teach kids this. They're called automatic negative thoughts, and ANTS for short. So we talk a lot about ANTS. And, you know, there's the fortune teller ant, where we're thinking about the future and how and that makes us anxious or that makes us angry. And so if we make it for kids, they kind of understand that, and we draw them. But our thoughts create our feelings. So if we shift our thoughts, we can shift our feelings.
I love that. I love that. I think that if we all learned, even at an earlier age, how much control we actually have over our minds, instead of feeling like our minds just sort of have our way with us, I think we would be a lot happier. I think we would feel a lot steadier. And I know that's definitely part of your mission in schools and with parents and families. And I love the work that you do. So thank you. Thank you for this conversation, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. And I will see you soon.
So if you're like me, you likely found it really helpful to understand the mechanics of the brain. So let me run through a few takeaways to outline them again, as well as a few more key elements from this conversation with Alicia. Number one, in its simplest terms, we have three main parts of the brain that impact our behavior. We have the reptile, or the survival area, We have the mammalian or the emotional area, and then we have the human or the executive area. It's helpful to be able to identify which part of the brain we're in or perhaps our kids are in so we know how to respond. For example, someone in the reptile center of the brain might have clenched fists and a red face. Your heart may race. You may start to sweat. That's your body getting ready for fight or flight. Someone in the mammalian center of the brain will be displaying a lot of big emotions, perhaps yelling or crying. It's not until we get back into the human or executive part of our brain that we can actually start to problem solve or work through conflict. Number two, we can move ourselves and the people around us back into the human part of our brain by connecting and keeping our own composure. This could be through eye contact, physical touch, or by using the DNA method, which stands for describe what you see, name the big emotion being expressed, and A, acknowledge the hurt or upset. Number three, sometimes stepping away from a highly emotionally charged person or moment is the best way to serve. When we gain our composure, we're far more likely to help others gain theirs. Number four, we're not always going to have composure. Sometimes we're going to lose it, but we can model the ability to have an oops and not have shame around it. We can say, everyone makes mistakes. What can I or we do better next time? Number five, play more. The people in our lives want to know that they are loved and that they are safe. One of the best ways to show this and to deeply connect on a regular basis is to have a spirit of playfulness around the relationship. Understanding the brain gives us a really objective way to understand behavior. We're not bad. Our kids aren't bad. They're just in a reptilian or mammalian part of the brain. When we can hone the skill of keeping our composure through lots and lots and lots of practice, we gain the ability to be with others' big emotions without getting sucked into them. And when we can keep our composure, we can keep the connection. Big thanks to Alicia Braccia for being my guest today. You can learn more about her work at www.learningandachievement.com. And thanks to you. Thanks for being here. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Until next time, keep on living the synced life.